Blog Talk Radio.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice. Fair use. Successful crowdfunding, how to ask for music rights, and what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com. Hi, and welcome to The Art of Film Funding. I'm your co-host, Claire Papin, along with Carol Dean, author of the best-selling book, The Art of Film Funding. Carol is also the founder and president of From the Heart Productions and the host of this show. Our guest, Troy DeVald, is a writer and producer most often associated with his work in reality television, credited on more than 200 hours of produced television. Troy has worked on many shows, some, just to name a few, Dancing with the Stars, Basketball Wives, and Hollywood Game Night. He's also the author of the best-selling book, Reality TV, An Insider's Guide to TV's Hottest Market. And Carol, I understand that Troy is published by Michael Weiss, who publishes your book as well.
Right. Troy and I are both supported by Michael Weiss Publications. And Troy, we really thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here, Carol.
So I really loved your book. I like the way you write. I feel like I know you. You just get, you're sort of like down home and easygoing, and you have a great sense of humor. And in the foreword to your book, it says, the reality of reality television is that there is a tremendous degree of creativity at work, especially in the storytelling, which is where many efforts are made to conceal the creative effort. So let's start with this. Tell us more.
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny that I've always felt, Sid Field had said about traditional scripted writing, that a lot of what your goal is to conceal the mechanics of what you do. It's to build a perfect machine and then sort of conceal the mechanics of what you do. It's exactly the same in reality television. There's a tremendous amount of creative effort that goes into these shows, from making sure that they're cast properly to ensuring that you have great outlines and things to shoot from and things planned for your cast members to do, because nothing really just falls through a lens. There aren't very many shows that are just sort of a natural follow. And as we've progressed in the industry, it's gotten to the point where, you know, shows are produced on tighter and tighter schedules, so you have to figure out really creative ways to make sure that things are happening with your cast members and that you have enough stuff that you can fill those 8 or 10 weeks.
Right. That's a lot of information, really, because I guess you shoot. What's your ratio of shooting to actually using? How much footage do you shoot versus what you use?
Well, that really depends on the show. Is sometimes, you know, when you've got a 4-month to 6-month shoot, you've got a much broader ratio and you can afford to throw things away. There are some shows that I've worked on where I might have 2 or 3 scenes left over at the end of the year that it's such a squeaker because we, you know, we've tried to make it work and tried to make things fit into an hour. But there are other shows where, again, it's super tight. I would say probably, I don't even want to try to guess at a ratio because there isn't one that really applies. We may shoot 10 hours or more for every, you know, 12-minute scene that you see on television, depending on, or 12 minutes worth of television or so. That's sort of the math that I've done myself. I don't know that there is a real number.
Well, that's an enormous amount of footage to go through to find the kernels that you want to use. That's incredible.
It is. It is. But we have, fortunately, you know, we great notes to work from in the field.
Unfortunately, what?
Oh, we just don't have very many. We have great notes in the field that help us to not have to review all of the tape and post. We don't start from zero when it comes back.
Oh, so you work from your notes a lot, then in this?
Very much. As if you've got, you know, an hour of dead space or a conversation where things didn't really happen or things didn't take off, it's much easier for us in post to communicate with the field team and to know that we've had kind of a dud afternoon, or you might or might not want to bother with this scene. The field team is an extremely important part of the way we set up story, just because, you know, they're out there gathering, they're keeping things moving along, and when they have a bad day, if they don't let us know, then we have a bad day because we end up having to review all the material to find out the same conclusion that they did.
Right. Well, that's really interesting. Let's go to your book again, because I really think
Sure. This
is a jewel. In the reality TV book, you say, why won't anyone just fess up and tell you how the shows are executed or how to get a job writing and producing them? So why is this, and how do you get a job in this genre?
Well, I'll tell you, I think the reason is, again, you go back to the thing that I said about Sid, about how you conceal the mechanics. But I think that there are a lot of production companies and networks that believe that if they don't conceal the fact completely that there's any creative energy being expended on a show, that somehow they're going to tilt their cards and the audience is going to say, oh, well, the whole thing's fake, we're just going to tune out, which is absolutely not the case anyway. If you're just setting an outline and people are following it, then that's not the same to me as, you know, saying, say this, now say this, in an extremely controlled, scripted environment. The reason why I don't think a lot of people have access to getting those jobs, writing and producing them, is because traditionally film schools and other places that we normally go to learn about a profession and to study a profession, reality television is only really being taken seriously fairly recently, because I think everyone had been convinced that it was a bit of a fad. And it's also, to be frank, it's not as sexy as film or TV, which is what drives enrollment in film schools, or people want to go in because they want to be Quentin Tarantino, they don't want to be Mark Burnett. You know, they want to be something that's you know, they want to be auteurs and tell their stories, and telling other people's stories is a different thing that, again, I just don't think appeals to them that much right out of the gate. So you have to sort of seek out people that are already working in the industry on your own and drop them emails and say, how do I get started? How do I get in?
Is this the best way, you think? Find people who are already there and work through them
Yeah, that's what most of us have done. And a lot of things, it's sort of like, you know, we understand the path very clearly when you get into film or television, that you start here and you can write a spec script and get noticed. You can't really write a spec script for a reality show because it's not possible. Those doors are closed because it's a very different side of the industry. So if you seek out people who know and who have been in the industry, it's almost the last place that I know that really works like an apprenticeship, is almost everybody comes in at some lower level. It doesn't matter how talented you are. It doesn't matter what you do. You're going to start either as a story assistant or a production assistant or something that just gets you in the door, and you learn as you go. There really isn't a way to jump in at that story producer level.
Well, is the current TV and film, are those schools still the best place to learn the craft and then get in as in the apprentice concept with reality TV?
I think it is. Personally, I think it is. I would say, I mean, there are types of people that function better, you know, just getting in and bashing around and learning as they go. And if you can do that, you don't incur the expense of going to film school. But I can tell you it benefited my rise greatly having gone, because I know a lot of the technical side of what's going on. It's not even a matter of, you know, understanding the creative flow. It's understanding that what a camera team can accomplish and what a sound team can accomplish and how things need to be set up and organized from a standpoint of actually physically getting a shoot done. Because, you know, producing in reality television involves all of those things when you get to the upper levels, when you start talking about the executive producers who are working in the field. You know, they're working on story, but they're also having to be very realistic about, you know, budgets and the allocation of resources, because these shows are produced on tight budgets. They might spend, you know, I've done shows as cheaply as $75,000 an episode and other shows that were maybe $1.5 million an episode.
Right. Great. Well,
so
all right.
Sort of global understanding works.
Okay, in the book you explained how you got your first job. I thought that was a great example of faith, so tell us that.
Oh, sure. Well, I think that everything happens once you actually step out and are just hopeful that there's a net. So what I had done was I just got in the car and came out to California and said, I don't have a place to live. I don't have a job. I'll figure it out when I get there. I cashed out my 401k from my old job as an executive assistant, but I didn't know it was going to take them 3 weeks to write me a check. So it was really something. I got about halfway across the country and ducked into a really cheap motel, the kind of place where they give you the key through a mail slot to get to your room. And while I was there, there was a show on MTV called Fear. And it was the first night the show had aired. I saw a familiar name go by at the end, was somebody that I had done plays with at the University of South Florida. It was super fortuitous. And I called Christo Garcia the next day and said, listen, I'm on my way to Los Angeles. I'm looking for work. I see you're working in reality TV. I need a day job. How does that work? And just by chance, that show was getting picked up to air. And he said, why don't you come in? I'll see if I can get you an interview and get you set up. And I ended up working as a logger transcriber on that show. Well, within the first year I was in LA, I had stayed with that company and had been a logger transcriber, and they would move me over into a position where I'd do location stuff and just kind of shift me around until eventually I was a story producer by the end of the first season on that show. So
wow.
I couldn't have been any luckier. I had a job pretty much as I landed in town.
Okay, well, let's start with logger producer. What is that? And tell us.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, what a logger transcriber is, and this is information that's changed a little even since the book was released. Logger transcribers review all of the footage, and they make time-coded notes that they pass on to the story team. So I might have an entry that says, at 11:10, they walk in the door. At 11:15, Sharon falls down screaming. 11:16, everyone rushes up the stairs to find out what's wrong with her. And those sort of notes go to the story team because they can read those and highlight them faster than they can watch the tape. And that's primarily what you're doing, is you're a very low-paid person who's going through it first so that the people who are paid more don't have to waste their time watching it. Logging and transcribing, the older I get and the further into the industry I get, the climate has changed a little bit, and there are houses that specifically just do logging and transcription that don't have daily contact with the story team the way that they used to. So logging and transcribing is becoming a slightly more difficult way to get into the business because most people don't still do that in-house. They farm it out.
Okay. Great. So, and then you moved from there, you moved up to what position?
From there, I moved up into an assistant story position and then into a full-on story producer position, which
okay,
back
what
in the
is
day...
assistant position?
Oh, sure. I'll tell you the whole thing. An assistant story producer, primarily, if I need footage or a specific thing, they go look for it. They may take a first pass at cutting together a scene on an Avid and then show me, you know, what they think the cut down of the scene is, and then I may go through and embellish that before it gets handed over to an editor. Pretty much, the assistant story producer is there to assist the story producer. What a story producer is the person who is actually responsible for the content of individual episodes or scenes before they're passed over to an editor, and then once the editor digs into them, in making sure that, you know, the content is hitting the sweet spots where it needs to before your executive producers and co-EPs see the internal rough cuts of your shows.
That's
so
amazing.
The story producer, yeah, and it's kind of a counterintuitive system for people that come from writing. And I've seen people, as much as I want to say that story is story and story is written, writers that jump the fence into reality television have a tough go sometimes because it's that thing where you think you're just going to create it from whole cloth, and sometimes you're just forensically assembling a story from things that happened weeks before that you had no participation in.
Right. Fantastic. Okay, so what job do you have these days? Are you still the story producer?
Well, these days I had been the co-executive producer on Basketball Wives on VH1 for about 3 years as of last year. Left that show to do Hollywood Game Night just because I thought it would be nice to have a game show under my belt. The one thing I try to avoid doing is having the same types of shows on my resumes for too long. because I think it narrows down your employability if they only know you as someone who can only do home renovation shows or someone who can only do, say, you know, docu-soaps. So try to do a little bit of everything. So now I'm over here on a new show for TV One that we're just getting off the ground called Hollywood Divas. So it's a little I try to keep it moving and do a little bit of everything because a good story producer or executive producer needs to know how everything works in order to have a really fulfilling career and maximize their chances for employment.
Right. Well, tell us in reality TV, what is a producer's role and what is the executive producer's role?
Well, it's interesting that you ask because it's very fluid from show to show. One of the interesting things about reality television is that so much of it is done in a non-union environment that there aren't a lot of lines that are drawn in the sand. And sometimes you end up running around and doing a lot more than you should, and sometimes you have a very specialized experience. There are co-executive producers and executive producers who concentrate primarily on story. There are executive producers in the field who are just making sure that that operation is running smoothly and that story is coming in, sort of overseeing the entire, you know, production side of things. And you have executive producers and co-executive producers that only work in post, piecing together that material that they're sending back. Typically, a story producer, though, is working for someone who is overseeing them as a co-executive producer or executive producer who is responsible ultimately for the end product of the show. So we have to answer to someone else. We're basically putting those stories together and kicking them upstairs to make sure that the network and the executive producers of the show are happy with the direction that we've taken.
Okay, so the executive producer is the one that's totally responsible for the show. It ends up being the quality and the story that they want, that they set out to achieve, right?
Precisely. And you'll find especially on reality shows, and it's happening in scripted too, is you'll have sometimes as many as 8 or 9 executive producers because some people at the network take that executive producer credit because they handle a lot of that work in-house where they used to farm it out. And executive producers, you know, with the production company that are going to take the title because they're executives of the company where it's produced, and then they're executive producers who are actually executing in the field and or post.
Well,
so again,
the original concept, I think, way back when, executive producer is someone who finds the money. But that doesn't seem to be the case here, or is it?
Not in the least. Well, more and more projects, I think, are originating. You know, the production company goes to the network, everybody approves, and then it ends up being a bit of a joint venture, is they get their budget from network as far as what they're going to do, and then, you know, some of these folks work in a no audit sort of situation where they get a certain amount of money for the show, and however they produce it is their business, and they keep whatever the overage is. So hunting for money in reality television, I'm glad I don't have to do it yet.
Yeah,
but that seems like a hard part. But I pitched to networks and things, and I suppose I'll find out when I get there.
You are pitching. You have ideas, and you are pitching for your own show?
Yes, and typically, you know, in that process when I pitch, I don't pitch as a production company on my own. I pitch in conjunction with other established production companies that have relationships with networks. It's just a lot easier. It's very rare that a creator will get meetings at the network level, although it does happen for me on occasion. In order for a first-time creator, and I know we'll get to it eventually here in the show, first-time creators, I always say, try to partner with an established production company that has a relationship with the network that you've designed your show for.
Right. I would think that's very important.
Yes.
Well,
they
want
to know that it's going to get done. So.
Exactly. That's the, I run into that judging documentary grant applications and short films and things that come through our grant, that's one of the key things that our judges are looking for. Will this film get finished? That's what we all want to see. Will it be made?
Yeah.
Well, I get a lot of filmmakers that call me and say that they have a brilliant idea for a reality TV show. So this is my question to you. How do you create a show and sell it?
Well, what I would tell you is there are certain things that you have. There's a little checklist that I run, sort of the 5 things that I always tell people to ask themselves before they go forward in creating a reality show to sell. is you want to make sure that it's a workable concept. If I have a thing that I want to do a reality show about people that are colonizing the moon, it's not going to happen. If I want to do something that's just, you know, I often use the example of the celebrity choir show. If I have a show where I have to have 25 celebrities form a choir every week, it's not a workable concept because it's impossible to cast a show like that, given the budget constraints of most reality television shows. So once you have that workable concept, you've got to ask yourself, is this a show that's sustainable? Can this run two or three seasons, or is this just kind of a gimmicky idea that's something that would run one or two times, and then you'd had completely expended your options? The third thing you should consider, once you have a workable concept and that plan to make sure it's sustainable, is you need to really consider, is there a buyer for it? You know, I have a series that's a real passion project of mine that I've worked on for years and years, and it's just every time I think there's a place for it, it's just too specialized and too niche. So if there's no network that carries the kind of thing that you want to bring forward, if there's no home for it, if there's no distribution or plan or no end buyer that is looking for the types of shows that you do, then again, that's a full stop, and you should move on to another idea. Beyond that, I would consider, you know, looking for representation, whether it's an agency or even if you're just using an entertainment attorney to approach people. There are so many firewalls that are set up just to keep people out of the business and just to keep the sheer volume of things to be considered down, that it really helps for you to have someone to help you navigate. And the final thing is, you know, if you're not going to be producing the content yourself, if you're not physically able to produce a television show by yourself, which no one really is, you need to look for a partner company when you're first starting out. Find someone who has a relationship already with the network that you plan to pitch to. If I find out that production company X is doing home renovation shows that have aired on HGTV, I might approach that company and say, look, I know you have a relationship with HGTV. I have a great idea for a show. Let's work together, or you just take my show, make me a non-participating producer, and I'll just take a small fee every year for this thing. The most important thing of all those five things is also just make sure you divest yourself of the notion that you're going to get rich off of the first show that you come up with. I've seen more people torpedo themselves going out thinking that they're going to get some sort of a huge deal, and frankly, the money is just not there anymore. The market has changed so much that people just want to pay a license fee. They want to produce the shows as cheaply as possible. And you have to have a realistic expectation of what is going to happen for you once that show comes out. If you clear that full checklist and those few additional hurdles, I think you may have something.
Well, if you were to get a check for every show, what would that be? Could you give us a broad concept?
It's very difficult to say. If you were doing, the only example that I've ever seen printed was, I remember that the gentleman who created a show for TLC called Clean Sweep was a show where they come in and they organize your house, they sell everything that you don't need at a yard sale, and they use the money to renovate or do a project for you. The creator of that show, I remember reading an article that he was paid something like $50,000 a season for having come up with the idea. Most likely, the scenario is that you become a non-participating producer. If you're brand new to the business, unless you have some reason to be participating in the weekly construction of that show, you shouldn't expect it. The reason for that, it's just that if you're not bringing value and experience to the production, you're an encumbrance to the production and people don't want to spend that money. If I come to you and I want to pitch a show where my brother is a famous football player and my brother and I are working together and the brother says, I'll do the show, but only if my brother works on it, then there's a reason for me to be working every week and taking, in addition to a fee, taking just a regular weekly salary out of that show. But that's a very rare situation. So the fantasy that you're also going to be able to produce that first show is something you really have to get over as well.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So
I didn't mean to be such a bummer on your show.
Well, no, we
That's just the way the world works.
It's the way it works. What can you just share what some of the budget ranges are on the average reality show that has lasted for a couple of years?
Well, I'll tell you, there are some shows that are very inexpensive to produce, and I think when you watch a lot of the home renovation shows and things for HGTV and for DIY, I would imagine that most of those budgets are anywhere in the range of maybe $75,000 an episode to maybe $150,000. Just very sort of low end, the kind of shows that you can shoot in 2 or 3 days, and then you send it back to post, and you're just dealing with those 2 or 3 days worth of content. When you start getting into things like docuseries and docusoaps where you have extended follows for 3 and 4 months, it might cost you $75,000 a week just for your crew to shoot that show. So the budgets on those shows tend to be in the maybe $250,000 to maybe $450,000 range as a per episode as far as what it would cost to produce that show. And then you start talking about the big spectacles where you have a lot of celebrity attachments. You have a very well-known host who might be drawing a fairly large salary. You start getting into Dancing with the Stars territory, and you're talking about, you know, maybe, and again, I don't know what the budgets are for Dancing with the Stars, so I'm not speaking for that show. I just use it as an example. Those shows might be anywhere from $800,000 to maybe $1.2 million, $1.5 million an episode. I'm sure there are some that are a little bit more and most that are pretty square in the middle of that range.
Okay. Good. That gives me a general idea. Well, let me go back. There's something you're talking about that I'd really like you to explain. What is a docu-series and a docu-sets?
Sure. Well, a docu-soap. What a docu-soap is, a docu-series is sort of a more of a natural follow, where you're looking at things like Anthony Bourdain, where he's going to different locations. He has a number of different places that he goes every season. And then you get down to docu-soaps, which are more of the things where you start looking at things that mimic a soap opera in the way that they're produced, in that there's an ongoing storyline where you have a cast of maybe 5 or 6 people and you're following them every single week from place to place. Those shows typically, would be shows like, the Real Housewives franchise or Basketball Wives or things of that sort that fall under that heading.
Okay, great. Okay, well, let's get on your book, Chapter 1. You say,
sure.
Let's follow this. And Chapter 1 says, story is story, and story is written, sort of. Where?
Yeah.
Tell us how that is.
Well, it's one of those things where it's a misconception that a reality show, that things just fall through the lens, and you can somehow sort that out and turn it into a reality show. When I say story is story is story is written, a lot of reality shows will go out into the field, will do a tremendous amount of research and find out that this person has this thing going on in their life, and we say to ourselves, okay, well, how do we talk about that for 6 or 8 episodes? Well, let's help them to get a meeting with someone over here, or we'll make sure that we get some scenes where they talk to their family about whatever their goal is that they're attempting to accomplish. They talk to their friends and they have little milestone conversations about, well, we were here, now we're here, now we're doing this other thing. It's all mapped out, so you're doing the outlining the same as you would do at the top of doing a traditional, script or screenplay when you're putting cards on the wall. The difference is the ride will sometimes take you somewhere else, and as things happen and they're not what you were planning, or you have surprises that come up, you have to figure out how to rewrite those outlines in order to make a coherent story that will wrap up within that 6 to 8 week period. So many of the same things, that you have to do in traditional scripted shows still have to be done. When you put a show together in post, you've got, if you're doing a 6-act show, you have to have a cliffhanger at the end of every act that's going to bring people back from commercial. You have to make sure that all of the information comes across, and if you don't understand something, you have to go back in and write a bite and say, I need you to tell me that after we went to this place, we went to this place, and what the reason was for that. Or let us know how you were feeling about something when it happened, things that you can embellish the story with. So there's story steps being taken all the way through the process of reality television, and ultimately your goal is to make your end product look the same way as a scripted product. is you want that same suspension of disbelief. You don't want to see the hand of the producer or writer hovering above what's happening to the point where people are sort of like watching marionettes. And that's what I mean by story is story and story is written.
I love it. Yeah. Well, it does work. I've seen some of those shows that I just couldn't stop watching. All right. Now, the home improvement show Exercise. Why do you call them lab frogs?
Well, because I can remember when I was back in school, when you had to go to biology class and you cut up that poor, defenseless, dead, euthanized frog. The reason that they have a lab frog for you is because they have fairly easily definable organs. It's also like working on vintage cars. The parts are bigger, it's easier to understand, and there's not a lot of computers and make complicated things. Home improvement shows almost always follow a sort of similar template. And what I outline in the book is sort of that thing where, you know, you're going to find out what the project is, you're going to meet the homeowner, you're going to find out what their goal is. In the first act, they're going to commence work after they've set the goal of selling the house in a week or whatever the impossible feat is. And then, you know, you'll have something go wrong. The example I think I used was, you know, oh, my wife left the hammer out in the rain, so I can't drive this nail. And then you go to your first commercial, you come back, hey, my wife found the hammer, everything's solved. You build to a bigger, some of them are just about that bad, but not most of them. There's a lot of good ones. And you get to the end of that act, and suddenly, you know, we couldn't get the flooring done in time, and we've scheduled a home, you know, we're supposed to show the house on Saturday. It's Thursday night. We don't have the flooring in yet. So they go to commercial, and you come back, and we've pulled an all-nighter, and by gum, we got the floor in. And then somebody comes in, looks at the house, and either buys it or gives you a positive review of what you've done with the house, or they tell you how much you've increased the value. Home improvement shows almost all work that way. So if you're trying to understand how things are scripted out and worked out as a format, they're great for study as a first-time reality show writer or producer.
Great. That's good to know. That's excellent. Now, I'm going right down your book. So I need you to give us an overview of Chapter 7, the different kinds of reality TV shows, and which ones are your top sellers.
Well, sure. Well, as we're going through that, the one thing that I'll say in the beginning is the world loves a list. And what I say in the book is that there's 7 or 70 or 700 kinds of reality shows, because there's so much hybridization of those shows going on. If you're watching The Bachelor, you know, you're watching a dating show that also has a reality competition element to it. So it's not neither a dating show nor a reality competition show. It's kind of both. There are certain types of shows that I talk about in Chapter 7. And of that list, you'll excuse me because I'm actually flipping through my own book so I can start at the top of the list properly. I had myself bookmarked. Is you have shows like there's supernatural shows, there are dating shows. I feel kind of uncomfortable with the list now because the book was written in 2011. And since then, we've seen a huge rise in what I call occupational shows, where people are basically following people who have unusual jobs. So it's an expanding list that I don't even necessarily stand by those first 7, because it's a constantly morphing thing, that there's always, you know, some new approach and some new list to be dealt with.
Okay. Well, just give us some of the names that you had, or that you know of, that are currently out there being made. Occupational shows, start with that.
Well, there's occupational shows. There are dating shows. I'll tell you right now, occupational shows are the hottest thing you can possibly have. People want to see occupational shows, and they really love shows with unusual families. Those are great, and the nice thing, too, is if you're creating those types of shows, you're going beyond creating a format. You're creating a show around something that you've built a connection with, in that if you go forward and you pitch a show with a family about a specific family, no one's going to do an end zone run around you and produce a show with that family if you have them under some sort of a talent agreement while you shop the show. it's the greatest opportunity for you to tie yourself in a way that you can't be extracted from the process and to bargain for a regular participation on the show because the talent is familiar with you and wants you on that show. What you'll see elsewhere, with dating, it's just a very difficult time for dating shows right now. In the same way that it's difficult for talk. The reason why is because a lot of those shows tend to air in the afternoon, and those slots are occupied by shows that have been running forever. The likelihood of you creating a show that's going to knock a daytime, if you're getting into talk, the likelihood of knocking a talk show off the air is very slim. Ellen's been on forever. That's her slot. A lot of the talk shows you'll see, like Queen Latifah and things like that, that's that very rare opportunity where something's gone off the air or been moved, and then you have that free space and everybody on earth, is trying to fill that. So I wouldn't waste your time in the talk space, which I still classify to some degree as reality. This is so funny. It's just I have all of my information in front of me, but it's just sort of sliding around and choosing not to agree with me. Carol, is there any chance that we could come back to that?
Sure. Let's production. What kind of tips can you give us in that area?
Well, sure. Production itself, the key to great production is great pre-production. Have an idea who your cast is. Really have a plan mapped out for them for the year, and don't cast people or write a show about people that are all essentially the same person. If I do a show about people who are aspiring models and I find 6 or 7 perfectly good-looking people who all have the exact same motivation and sort of look the same and have the same family life, that they're all single and running around like crazy, it's very hard to create personalities that play off of each other. In pre-production, you want to make sure that your show has been what's referred to as being cast for conflict, is you want people that will have differing opinions. Fantastic example of this is The Real World. If you go back into the early seasons of that show in the early 90s, you'll have cast members where they're looking for sort of the cowboy, the kind of sweet rural guy. They'll have someone who's kind of the whoever's representing the quote-unquote urban chick, urban guy. You'll have someone who perhaps is an activist. Everybody has a very specific role that they've been cast in. Another good example of that is, Ron Jeremy and Tammy Faye Baker being cast in The Surreal Life, the second season. You have an adult film star going in with a former televangelist. The likelihood that they'll disagree on a few things is fairly high, so that you actually will have drama occurring on your show. Once you move forward from that into production, the only thing I can tell you is that you really have to map out a purpose to every scene so that when people get together, you can just kind of lean in and say, what I'd love for you to do at the top of this conversation is just discuss, what happened to you last Thursday, and let this other person know how you feel about it and how it's going to affect your relationship moving forward. That's not the same as scripting a scene. It's not asking them to say a specific thing, but you do want to prompt the discussions that are going to get you forward. From a story perspective, that's the most important thing in production, is to make sure that there is story occurring and story is moving forward. And if it's not, you need to figure out ways to very quickly sort of poke that until something moves.
Well said.
I know
okay.
That's a strange way to describe it, but you do have to kind of nudge people along sometimes.
Right. So, and if you don't, the next discussion I wanted to have was post-production horrors.
Oh, absolutely.
And if you don't, then the guys in post are over there saying, and I'm quoting from the book, well, was that sound guy asleep? Or how could they not have covered that issue, right?
Yeah. Well, it's that one of the things that drives me crazy is you'll be working in post, and it's that thing, something will slip by and happen off camera that's fantastic on almost every show. And the thing that's agonizing about it is the people in the field are so amazed by the fact that it happened that they will say things like, and then so-and-so had this huge argument with this person, and it happened off camera, but then this happened, and they're telling you what happened in the field as if it's all available to you to cut together. Not enough people start hearing that, and then the network starts hallucinating. They start thinking, well, where is the scene where this happened? Well, you don't have it. It didn't happen. So you have to figure out ways to make sure that things that happen off camera get mentioned in conversation. You know, just in order to give that full picture, you can't get from A to Z if you're going to skip M and S and R. You've got to have the whole alphabet there or it doesn't work. So
right.
There's also, you know, issues where you have beautiful scenes where, you know, the sound quality isn't so good. You know, for some strange reason, watch a reality show where they shoot something in a club or an environment where they may have been playing a lot of music that we can't afford to clear. You know, not everybody has a budget where you can pay $17,000 because you were having a conversation and Britney Spears was on in the background. You know, you've got to figure out different ways around that. So it's just a matter of making sure that production has the presence of mind to do things in a way that aren't going to create huge problems for you in post. And there's a reason why there's always been that phrase, we'll fix it in post. A lot of people, that's the attitude. We're going to get what they get, and they'll sort it out. Well, it helps us if you put a little thought into it.
Yes, and it saves a ton of money in post, doesn't it?
It does indeed. It gets a lot of times it's very fiddly. There are little things that are just silly. I worked on a television show once where, you know, there were a lot of things that were being shot in a room that had a wall of windows. And when they shot at night, it was reflections of the crew members and cast featured very prominently in the windows. So we had to go in and pay somebody to digitally paint people out of the windows. So that's $30,000 I'd rather not spend every time that happens.
Right. Oh, my gosh. I bet you've seen it all.
I've 14 years, I've seen a lot of it.
But
everybody tries. That's the thing. There's always going to be something. You can't, you know, the blame game after the fact is no good for anybody. So you just kind of got to roll your eyes and figure out how to fix it.
Fix it, yeah. It's always how to fix it. Well, I loved your chapter, Get to Work. So tell us your, again, what you think you need to do to get your foot in the door on a show.
Well, for reality television, what I would tell you is if you want to get your foot in the door on a reality show, you've got to come in from the bottom. And it's that thing where, you know, we all feel, you know, that sense of entitlement. If we've done a few scripted projects and then we want to jump over to unscripted, we should be able to enter at that level. Doesn't always work. I would suggest looking for work, anything that gets you into the building at a major company that produces multiple shows as opposed to a boutique house that may have one or two shows and then go dark for a while. Look for those big companies. Look for work as a production assistant. Look for work as a logger transcriber, but only if that company is a production company that does its own logging and transcription. Anything that kind of gets you in the door. And once you're there, interact with, if you're interested in story, interact with the story department on a level where you can say, I've just seen 5 scenes in a row over the last 2 days that deal with this. If you're not tracking it, you might want to do that. It's what I did, and the story department ended up lobbying to bring me into story because they got so used to me taking that little extra bit of effort. It's never good enough to do your job with your head down and hope that people notice you. You have to go a little bit extra, and you know, the executive producers, when I first started on my first show, I had a night shift. I worked from 7 p.m. to 3 in the morning as a logger transcriber. Well, they all went home at 5. So I would come in at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and wander around and talk to the story people about what I saw the last night, and then I might leave and go to dinner. And one of the EPs said, why are you always in at 4 o'clock if your shift doesn't start until 7? And I told him right to his face, I said, because you and I would not be having this conversation if I came in when I was supposed to come in. I need
right.
you to know who I am, and I need you to know that I really want this job. You've
good,
got to,
and
got to
it helps.
Stuff like great. Yeah, and do it in a way where it's not about bragging about yourself. It's just about trying to make yourself a conspicuous help. You know, let people know, you know, how badly you want to help them look good.
That's
and that'll,
important.
And that'll usually grease things up for you.
Right. Right. Okay, well, let's go to parting shots, because I think that's a great chapter. Give us some of your sage advice.
Well, parting shots, I asked a lot of friends of mine just to kind of give me whatever their bits of advice were. You know, some of the best ones, I think, you know, Nick Emerson, who at the time was the head of Shed, which was the company that I worked on for Basketball Wives, one of the things that I had asked him was, I said, you know, when you create a show, what's important for you to have in place before you go out with the idea? And he just said, you know, that the more work you've done on the idea, the harder it is for someone to steal it. So do your write-up, make a sizzle DVD if you can, and let your lawyer know that it's going out, or let you, or pitch it through an agency or somewhere where there's a record that it's going out. I know you've probably heard a million stories from people who say, well, I pitched this thing and they stole my idea.
Right.
The reason that people say that they stole their idea is because they had an idea. If they had a complete execution, it's awfully hard to steal that. If I tell you that I want to do a show about wealthy housewives in Beverly Hills, well, what does that mean? You know, does that mean I want to just follow them around? Does that mean that they're working on a project together, or people who work together in Beverly Hills? Is it just a bunch of women who work at a plastic surgery office? Is it about, you know, women who meet for lunch once a week? Are they old? Are they young? What are they? Really flesh out your idea, and again, like I say, have that plan in place for 1, 2, or 3 seasons so that people know that you have somewhere to go with it, and then all of a sudden you've got something you can sell, as opposed to just what most people say when they have an idea for a reality show. They say, you know, it's about people who work in a junkyard. Well, what does that mean? you just have to work it out. So that advice from Nick was very helpful to me in the beginning. Brian Gibson, who I had worked with on Dancing with the Stars, this is the other thing. When you have to get in, I tell you to start at the bottom whenever you can. I worked as a logger transcriber for Brian Gibson during some downtime after I'd already been a producer. I went backwards for 6 weeks because I'd rather be at work than sit at home. Well, Brian, I would have never worked with him if I hadn't gone backwards. And he's the one that put me up for the job on Dancing with the Stars, which up to that point was the biggest network show I'd ever worked on. You know, so you never know where you're going to make those connections. But his big advice was take some pride in what you do.
Right.
You know, it's reality television, and you know, I always say we're kind of the Rodney Dangerfield of entertainment. Is there's not a lot of respect for reality television in the way that a well-executed scripted show or a movie, you know, generates buzz and interest and admiration. But still, you know, and this guy isn't quoted, but Mel Shearer, who was a writer that worked with Andy Kaufman and a lot of great people over the years, you know, he said something similar to me, which was to write even bad stuff, you have to convince yourself that you're writing good stuff. You have to put the love in there. You know, otherwise it really shows. You know, you can elevate a terrible concept to mediocrity, but it's very hard to, you know, take a terrible concept and make it better by treating it like you don't want to be there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. All right. Well, I want to know more about your blog, which is called Remember,
sure.
We're Not Here, Reality Television Podcast. Where is it and what's
yeah.
it all about?
Well, Remember, We're Not Here. We just started it a little over a month ago. And I've had a blog that's been up for several years where I offer advice on reality TV production, which is just realitytvbook.com. There's a link there that will take you to the podcast. But what I've been doing is sitting down with people who are story producers and executives and talking about sort of how they got their start. Every week we play a game of something I call real or fake, where I come up with an idea for a reality show, and you tell me whether that show's actually been executed or whether it's a completely phony show. It's often very hard to tell because the concepts are always a little bit more outrageous when it comes to reality television. So we goof around on that. We get a little bit of advice about, you know, what's the thing that you wish you knew when you got into the industry. And we've had some great people on. We had Joey Ortega, who was the manager of development for Howie Mandel's company for Alivi Entertainment, was our first guest. Andrew Hoagland, who I've worked with on Basketball Wives for years and years, and who I'm now working for on this new show, is a guest. We've got John Collins is going to be out this Sunday, who has worked on lots and lots of really good shows. And it's a lot of fun because, you know, we don't really hear from the people in reality TV that much. You know who some of the creators are. You know who Mark Burnett is. You know who Mike Fleiss is. But there's an awful lot of work you got to do before you end up being one of those guys. And these are the people that tell you what it's like in the trenches. So we have a lot of fun.
That sounds so exciting. So tell me again, it's realitytvbook.com.
Yep. If you go to realitytvbook.com, just look on the right-hand side, and there's a link that will take you to all of our archive podcasts. iTunes has been very slow in picking them up. There are some episodes that are available already on iTunes and many more that are in the queue that should be there shortly.
Okay. Now, how about your book? Where do we buy that?
You can buy that pretty much anywhere they sell film and TV books. You can buy it through MWP.com. I know that it's slightly discounted there presently. And also at Amazon.com, it is available for the Kindle if you are very fond of trees. You can just download a digital copy and enjoy.
Okay, got it. So what's coming up for you? What exciting is happening in your new future?
Well, you know, it's always hard to tell. In reality television, it's sort of like driving with your headlights off at night. There's always going to be something that will jump out in front of you that you didn't expect. If you would ask me 2 weeks ago if I was going to be working on Hollywood Divas, I would have had no idea. Again, it's just a lot of times because reality TVs, you can get them to air a little faster sometimes than scripted because it takes a little less time to put them all together. Those shows, they tend to order them a little closer to the air dates. So sometimes you're up against air and you don't know until just a little bit before. But as far as what's up for me coming up, in September, I will be part of the Story Expo in Los Angeles, where I'll be lecturing about basically the how to get into reality television and when you're creating an original series, the things you need to do. I'll also be at some point, hopefully in the fall, we might be doing another TV Writers Summit. If you follow TVWritersSummit.com, Chad Gervich and Jen Grisanti and Ellen Sandler and I go out as a foursome to different cities, and we do a two-day seminar and sometimes workshop that you can get into. We've done them very successfully in London and Tel Aviv, and we just had a great one here in Los Angeles. And you get a little bit more—you get a little bit more time to talk to us at those. So definitely, that's something to look into. So you can follow us either at TVWritersSummit.com or Story Expo has its website up. And Story Expo is huge. There's the last one we did, it was the last time that Sid Field spoke, he gave the keynote at the last Story Expo. We've had John Truby come out, so there are people there who are talking about traditional scripted as well as reality. It's really an exciting couple of days.
Oh, what fun that sounds like. Thank you so much, Troy. Great interview.
Oh, my pleasure.
And you shared so much information, and we sincerely appreciate it. So we'll be looking forward to watching what happens on your exciting realitytvbook.com. We'll go there. And remember, we're not here, your reality television podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Carol.
Okay, thanks. And thank you, Claire.
Oh, yes, thank
you.
Thank you. Very good show. Very good show. Learned a lot here. Everyone be well.
Good.
Thank you.
Well.
Bye.
Watch more reality TV because it's good for you.
Will do.
All right, bye-bye.
I want to remind our listeners that David Raiklin is a brilliant and talented award-winning musician who scores films and can compose music for a trio or for a full orchestra. David is a very good friend to the independent filmmaker and comes highly recommended by From the Heart Productions. If you need music to help tell your story, please contact him at davidraiklin.com. That's David, RAIKLEN.com. And Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at FromTheHeartProductions.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good luck with your films, everyone.